Good afternoon. I would like to begin by thanking each of you for coming out this afternoon to hear our guest speaker. This is the second session of the Graduate Workshop in Diplomatic History for the current academic year, and I am delighted to be able to introduce to you Dr. Akira Irie, who is the Charles Warren Professor of American History at Harvard University. Professor Irie has been a strong voice in the field of diplomatic history for the importance of culture, integrating culture into the study of foreign affairs, and he has been a pioneer in the effort to internationalize the study of diplomatic history as well. Professor Irie is the author of many books, including Power and Culture, The Japanese-American War, 1941 to 1945, Cultural Internationalism in the World Order, and Global Community, The Role of International Organizations in the Making of the Contemporary World, just to name a few. Professor Irie is also past president of the Society for Historians of American Foreign Relations. He held that office in the year 1978, and he is indeed one of Schaefer's most eminent members. Today he'll speak to us about his current research, which he has entitled From International History to Transnational History. In a minute, I'll ask you to help me in welcoming Professor Irie to the podium. We will follow our usual format of the graduate workshop by beginning, actually, by going around the room and having each of you introduce yourselves to your colleagues and to our guest. Take 10 to 18 seconds apiece to share your name and your place in the program, your program here at Ohio State. For those of you who are visiting Ohio State today, I hate to impose on you if you want to share your name and indicate that you're one of our prospective students visiting the Department of History today. Professor Irie will talk for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then on the assumption that most of us have done the reading that was distributed ahead of time, we'll save the balance of our time for questions and comments and discussion. So help me in welcoming Professor Irie, and then we'll have our introduction. Yeah, we'll start here on my right and with Robert, and we'll go around, and then you can start.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm Robert Robinson, I'm in my fourth year at the Diplomatic History Program.
I'm Brian Caddy, this is my second year undergraduate program.
I'm Paul Chamberlain, I am my second year.
My name is Joe Orstra, I'm one of the prospective students.
Mark Wright, I'm my first year at the PhD program.
I'm Jamie Fowler.
I'm Matt Eats, and I'm also a prospective
student.
I'm Alex Stiff, I'm
entering
my 42nd year. I'm doing culture and American culture abroad at MF.
Don Henderson, I'm in my 5th year of graduate studies.
Rajiv Khanna, 5th year, I'm with Professor Pate.
I'm Amanda Rossi, I'm in my 1st year, and I'm also
I'm Marshall Green, I'm in my 3rd year, and I'm also
I'm Jennifer Stegall. I'm in my only second year of teaching here in diplomatic, European diplomatic and military history.
I'm Dustin Walter. This is my fourth year of graduate program.
Franz Rademacher, second year of European diplomatic history.
Ryan Irwin, first year U.S. diplomatic.
Stephen Riding's Ward, second year in diplomatic.
Alex Poster, second year diplomatic history.
Joel, second year military history.
Julie Rajewski, Rashawn Pepin.
Robert Kelly, I'm from the political science department.
We have like four of us here. We allowed you here.
My name is Kurt Kumachek. I'm also a political scientist and postdoctoral fellow here at Marshawn.
My name is Sasha Buchek. I'm a political scientist, third year.
My name is Dominique Dirk. I'm in American history, first year.
John Mueller, political science, and Rashawn Sutter.
Alex Lentz, political science, and Rashawn
Sutter. And Dave Steigerwald, Department of History.
Thank you very much. Actually, we'd like all the political scientists to leave and get free friends and come back. Thank you very much. Okay, please.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's nice to see so many of you. I'm rather envious that we don't really have as many people doing diplomatic history, international history at Harvard University. We only take in about 15 to 16 graduate students a year, and with the department with the faculty size of about 50, that means about we get the three of us have to combine together to get one graduate student, and it's not very often that, despite the fact that there are a number of us doing international history, that we get a graduate student. Sometimes we go without anybody in our field coming in to study with us. Some other times we may get one. If you're really lucky, you may get two. So to have this many people doing the field, not just in history, in political science as well, is very impressive. And you may be having as many as four new students next year, right? That really makes it a very creative, good creative mass. Professor Hahn said that I was going to talk about my current research. I hate to disappoint you. I don't particularly have a research project right now. What I do have in front of me in terms of what I'll be doing after my retirement. This is the time when I'm facing my retirement. At the end of June, I shall be retiring. So that also makes me envious of you people here for just starting their graduate careers. I wish I were in your shoes. And back again in 1957 when I was a first-year graduate student. And then having done that, having worked in this field, since then I decided the time had come for me to just retire from teaching, but hopefully not from research and writing. And I will say something about my post-retirement projects, but I thought I would like to say a bit about the field, or it may not even be the field, but something that we call transnational history today, and see how I conceptualize that and how, in my opinion, how that might be related to what we have all called international history. I think the field has been called diplomatic history and international history. And whether there is a difference between diplomatic history and international history is something we can talk endlessly about, but I think we will assume that whether we call it diplomatic history or international history, we are all engaged in some study of the history of international affairs. I started doing that, and I am still doing it, but the past 10 years or so I have become increasingly interested in what I call transnational, which may be just another name for international. I want to talk about that. What may be slightly different, it may be what I would like to call that, some kind of a companion to international history, or some kind of an addition to the much more established field of international history. And because you may have been able to take a look at a couple of chapters of my most recent book, the most recent, even though it's already more than 2 years old, 2002, I wrote this book called The Global Community, which is a study mostly of international organizations, but particularly of the non-governmental variety, study for NGOs. How I got to write a book like that, which may be put in the framework of transnational history, is something that I'd like to start talking about today, and then go on to talk more about the field itself. Many other diplomatic historians, when I was in graduate school in the 1950s and then did my dissertation in the 1960s, I defined my research project in terms of the old framework of international history, meaning materia archival, study of how nations or how governments interacted with each other. I was particularly interested in what today is called international order, world order, how a particular international order is established at a given moment in time. And at that time, I think, for example, Henry Kissinger's work on the Vienna Conference is very famous. As you know, Kissinger has a really established a scholarly reputation anyway, by working on the Congress of Vienna. That served as some kind of model, that is to say that after 20 or more years of warfare in Europe, there was a Congress of Vienna, and the powers came together and established some kind of a system for European governance, European international order that I think he calls and others have called the Vienna system. Later in the 19th century, the Vienna system, of course, no longer exists, and William Lange, another very prominent diplomatic historian who taught for many years at Harvard, had written a book in the 1930s, I think, called The Diplomacy of Imperialism. That, I think, was a book that surveyed the policies of various imperialist powers, but I think one argument in the one framework is that there was a diplomacy, a diplomatic tradition, practice of imperialism, that the imperial powers together established some kind of a global order. I think those of you who have been following Neil Ferguson's recent writings, Ferguson's book about a couple of years ago on empire, and more recent about the would-be American empire in the 21st century, as he argued, has an echo of that. I think it comes from that kind of tradition of saying that when you have number of global empires at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, they together managed to establish some kind of a global order, a global system. I think 1980s and 90s, another European diplomatic historian, University of Illinois, Paul Schroeder, wrote about the 18th century and 19th century, again, European international orders. It's a pretty magnificent book, I think published in 1992 or 93, called The Transformation of European Politics. It's going over somewhat the same grounds that Kissinger had, but going back really to the 18th century, talking about the emergence of a European order in the 19th century, all the way to 1848. So I think my own work fits into that sort of thing, in the sense that I have also been very interested in these international systems, international orders, particularly in regional orders. And I did my dissertation, and that became a book published 40 years ago. And I was just appalled to realize that it's already 40 years ago I did my first book on basis of my dissertation, which is called After Imperialism. It's a study of the 1920s in Asia and the Pacific. The argument is pretty straightforward, that William Lange's kind of diplomacy of imperialism had described a system of international relations that had been established by the imperialist powers. That, I argued in my book, was no longer tenable. I mean, obviously, because of the war, the Great War, that had destroyed empires of the Ottomans and Austrian Empire, the Russian Empire, and German Empire. And the remaining empires, and the colonial empires, there were still some, like France and Britain, the United States was still a colonial empire, having acquired and holding on to the Philippines and Japan. But they were no longer able to perpetuate any kind of an imperialistic system of global governance. In view of the fact that the United States itself, at Wilson, had turned against imperialism, and in Russia, of course, you have the new anti-imperialistic diplomacy after the Bolshevik Revolution, and you have the rise of nationalism in India and China and Egypt and all over the world. So my argument in that book was that what happens when these imperialistic powers are no longer able to maintain any kind of system of global governance. Well, they had to do something to replace the system. That's why I called the book After Imperialism. Imperialism had not ended. I mean, my book was criticized severely by Russian historians at the time in the 1960s, saying that, well, what you're talking about after imperialism. Imperialism still existed in the 1960s, and so to talk about after imperialism was rather not anachronistic, but was wrong. But nevertheless, I argue that in the Asia-Pacific context, what the United States and Britain and Japan did was to re-establish some kind of regional order, not on the basis of holding on to the colonial empires, but on the basis of some kind of accommodation with Chinese nationalism, 1920s. That's something that I called the Washington system, the way Kissinger had called the Vienna Congress order, the Vienna system. I called that the Washington system, based upon the Washington Conference. Continued to function until 1931 or 1930s, when one member, one constituent member of that system, namely Japan, defected from it and decided to establish another order, right? This is the new Asian order that Japanese militarists tried to establish in the late 1930s, and so on and so on. One could talk about international affairs this way by focusing upon regional systems, regional orders. In subsequent writings, I talked about the Yalta system after the Yalta Conference of 1945, in which the victorious powers in the Second World War, UK, US, the USSR, came together to define some kind of a post-war international order. That was in effect established, I think, by the end of the Second World War, but it was very short-lived because shortly thereafter, the members of the Yalta system were not able to stick together, were not able to sustain the system together, and the United States and Soviet Union could no longer be working together to maintain that order. They're going separate ways, and instead of the Yalta system, we have something else called the Cold War. We can even talk about the Cold War system. In the Asian context, instead of the Yalta system, which would have meant that the United States, Soviet Union, China, and Great Britain in Southeast Asia would have been the main architects of some kind of regional order after 1945, they'll no longer be able to do that. China going on, the regional order becomes split up between the Soviet-China angle axis on the one hand and US-Japan axis. I have often used the term the San Francisco system to describe American dominated security arrangement in Asia after the 1950s, where the San Francisco Peace Treaty and Security Treaty between U.S. and Japan provided the basic framework. But that was not the entire picture, because it was pitting itself against the Soviet-Chinese system of regional order. So you have the conflict there, just as there was a latent Cold War kind of confrontation in Europe. And so on. I think, in other words, one could talk about these kind of international affairs by focusing on the question of global or regional governance. And nowadays, I think one can talk about regional communities, European Union and various other regional communities that are springing up in Southeast Asia. Later on, I'll refer a bit to the East Asian, the new East Asian order that is now being talked about in East Asia, China, Korea, Japan, and so on. So I think this is one way that international history has been studied. You look at either the entire global system itself, or look at different parts of the world, Europe, Asia, Middle East, even though the Middle East is, I think, has not been as fully explored, and I'm glad that under Professor Hahn's leadership, many of you are doing that right now. I think it's a very, very important development. But I think in Europe, in East Asia, Latin America, I think we have had some very good studies of regional systems of governance, of regional communities, of regional orders. And I have enjoyed, I had fun working on these kind of topics. But then I think in the past 20 years or so, I began to be interested in non-state actors, so-called, or non-state forces. I mean, basically, the more traditional study of international history focuses on states and governments or nations. And regional order, of course, is one that is established when nations come together, or some countries come together and decide to establish some kind of scheme for regional governance. I think starting from about 1980s, I came to the realization that in addition to states and governments, or even in addition to national communities, people, that is, case of the United States, in addition to the U.S. government, U.S. military, and so on, and even in addition to those who identify themselves with the country, with the United States, American industry, business communities, religious organizations, individuals, they all define themselves within the national framework. That's fine, and I did begin to talk about American images of other countries and so how Americans perceive other countries, how certain American ideologies may have influenced the shaping of American foreign policy. That is fine, but these are still taking the nation as the basic unit of analysis, either the state or the nation is still the basic unit of historical analysis. But then I also began to be to notice, I think, that there are phenomena or developments or forces in international affairs that may not be so closely identifiable with a particular country. Of course, obviously, there are non-governmental organizations, non-state actors. By non-state actors, usually meant those that are not identifiable with the state, meaning, in the case of the United States and other capitalist countries, of course, the business organizations are very much non-state actors, and there are all kinds of NGOs and religious organizations, and so there are all kinds of organizations that may not be totally identifiable with the nation, in the sense when the business organizations pursue their profits, or NGOs pursue aims such as the protection of the environment, or the protection of human rights, and so on. The activities may not just be confined to the national boundary, or that they might not always act in the name of the nation. And in fact, they may be establishing transnational connections, that they may be sharing certain interests and certain ideas with their counterparts elsewhere. It's these kinds of transnational developments that began to interest me in the 1980s, and I wrote a book in 1992, I think it's called, Focusing on China and Japan. It's called China and Japan in the Global Setting. And I must thank Ohio State University for that, because I was invited to a group such as this in either 1988 or 1989. And I was talking about culture, the way I was emphasizing culture in my study of international affairs. And then some students asked me, well, how about economics? And that was a very important question, because when I talk to culture, is economics culture or is it not culture? Then what is economics? Because when you talk about international affairs, of course, you cannot ignore economic relations, right? Like trade and investment, rates of exchange, and all those economic things. But so including those kinds of economic phenomena into my definition of culture. I just remember I was taken aback by the question. It's just such a good question. That's why I say I'm very grateful to Ohio State University graduate program for that, because that got me thinking about economic transactions. And I decided, because I was just writing a book about China and Japan, the history of Chinese-Japanese relations, and I decided to give it a tri-dimensional, tripartite treatment. That I said the first part of the modern history of Chinese-Japanese relations from the late 18th century to the First World War was mostly a product of Japan's power, Japan's search for greater power. So there, whether we're talking about economics or culture or anything else, the key, I thought, at the time was the fact that Japan really wanted to augment its power. And it went to war against China, it went to war against Russia, it established its colonies in Asia. So I think you could view that phase of Chinese-Japanese relations in the framework of just power politics, a more traditional kind of geopolitics. Then, after 1945, after the Second World War, I thought rather than power, the key there to post-war Japanese-Chinese relations was more economics, where despite the political differences, ideological differences, despite the fact that Japan was an ally of the United States and China was an ally of the Soviet Union, trade flourished. I mean, there was a lot of trade, even in the 1950s, 1960s, before the normalization that comes only in 1978. So I thought economics there was a very important factor. You could not explain these things by any other factor. So I decided economics was a very important ingredient there, an independent variable, so to speak. And then for the in-between period, between the First World War and the Second World War, namely the 1920s and 1930s, I thought their culture becomes very, very important. Of course, you have Japanese imperialism, the power factors there, and you have economics, of course, but what was particularly interesting about Chinese-Japanese relations in the 1920s and even 1930s was the real flourishing of cultural exchange, student exchange programs, and various other movies and various other ways in which the two countries became culturally interconnected. So I thought, anyway, and so that's why I wrote that little book in terms of the three key themes of power and culture and economics. That was one way in which I thought I could begin to talk about some cross-national movements of ideas and goods, particularly in the 1920s when Chinese and Japanese began to exchange their, not only their goods, which they had been doing, but also the exchange of students, exchange of ideas, developed some kind of transnational consciousness, so to speak. It didn't last too long, because by the 1930s, you have another development, but even my argument was that even in the 1930s, these kinds of cultural transnational exchange did not disappear altogether. I wanted to push that kind of idea that in addition to these more geopolitical relations among nations, there are transnational developments, forces that needed to be studied. And that's what got me to do a study of basically cultural exchange. In the book I published in 1997 called Cultural Internationalism and World Order, there the basic argument is that there is such a thing as cultural internationalism, meaning the idea that these transnational exchanges of ideas and students, including things like tourism, including things like common the study of universal language such as Esperanto, or anything, all those transnational cultural phenomena have become quite extensive from the turn of the 20th century and continue to grow. Of course, there are ups and downs in this. The decades of the 1930s were not particularly notable for these kinds of cultural exchanges, but nevertheless, there was this phenomenon which it does not need to fit into the usual view of international affairs. And I argued in that book that when people say, what does it matter? I mean, this is the so-called so what question. So students exchange across national boundaries, or certain ideas or movies are shared across national boundaries. But then people say, well, so what? What's the importance of it? People say, well, the French and Germans before 1914 used to travel to each other's country, used to read each other's books and listen to each other's music all the time. But so what? That did not prevent war from erupting in 1914 and so on. And my answer to that is, of course, I mean, the fact does remain that there is a war in 1914, there is a war in 1939, and so on. But that's okay. I mean, of course you can study wars in their own frameworks in terms of the coming war and the conduct of war and so on. But that does not mean that these other phenomena, transnational phenomena, do not have their own importance, not in terms of wars or diplomacy. I mean, I think I would be willing, I think, to say that, in fact, there might not be such an easily recognizable pattern of the impact of anything transnational upon international affairs. That is, if you're talking about international conflict, more traditional themes of diplomacy and conflict and so on, then those are phenomena might really have nothing to do with that story, as the French-German story before 1914 indicates. But as I said, the Chinese and Japanese really were exchanging the students and ideas and all kinds of things. They were producing movies together in the 1920s and early 1930s. That did not prevent a horrendous war from taking place. My argument there is that, of course, one cannot establish an immediate connection, but the fact does remain that these things did occur. And we cannot quite obliterate these things that people were doing, right? Not the military, not the governments, but individual, private individuals, their groups or business communities and so on, what they were carrying out, what they were doing, had their own history. That's when I began to think about something like transnational history as somewhat separate from international history. We can write a history of transnational transactions and say that these really don't have much of an impact on international relations. Thinking along these lines, I wrote this my latest book, Global Community, that some of you may have taken a look at. It's the same thing, basically, that I grant that there is a high drama, high story of the First World War and Second World War and Cold War and so on. That's the story that's most visible. But it does not mean that there's nothing else that matters. Of course, economic historians will tell you that, of course, there's intensive trade and monetary transactions and shipments of capital and so on. These are very, very important. In addition to those, I was struck by the fact that another phenomenon which had not really been recognized by historians, even though political scientists have been much more alert to that phenomenon, I think, aware of the phenomenon, that a spectacular growth in the number of international organizations, particularly of the non-governmental variety, so-called NGOs, and international NGOs are abbreviated as INGOs. I was studying INGOs, that is, internationally interconnected NGOs. The best examples today would include things like Amnesty International and Doctors Without Borders and things of that kind. I was struck by the fact that I decided that I would like to study some of these, having become very interested in this kind of non-state phenomenon, transnational phenomenon. I was led to the existence of a large number, and really large number, starting from just a handful of such international NGOs in the 19th century. It continued to grow after the First World War in the 1920s. Even in the 1930s, the number kept growing. That number really leaps after 1945, and particularly 1970s. It's a very, very interesting phenomenon. From about, I forgot, something like, what's it, several hundreds in the 1960s of these international NGOs. The number jumps to, what is it, 12,000 or something like that by the end of the 1970s, and today they're said to be about 30 or 40,000 international NGOs. Depends on who is counting, but these are, at least if you look at figures established by an international body that serves as the headquarters in Brussels, the international headquarters for all these international organizations, about 30 to 40,000 of those. That's what I'm talking about in this book. That is, what do you think about wars and Cold War and all of these more traditional phenomena? And I'm not saying they're not important. I think we should all study those things. The origins of the Cold War is a very important phenomenon, as is the ending of the Cold War. All of that are very, very important, significant phenomena. And yet, at the same time, we should not ignore the fact that there has been a spectacular, really remarkable growth in the number of international NGOs, which, by the way, coincides with a spectacular growth of multinational corporations, you know, the international business organizations that also grew in the 1970s. This is a sort of footnote to my presentation that we really have to conceptualize 1970s. I think it's 1970s. The usual view of 1970s is that, well, you have Nixon and detente, which is followed by Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution, and so you go from a rather promising detente to what some people call the Second Cold War in the late 1970s, and so on. And then Reagan comes on the scene until Reagan and Gorbachev work out their final ending to the Cold War. And that's one scenario. But when you just only focus on those kind of things, on the detente and SALT I, SALT II, Afghanistan, we would never know that underneath the drama there was the tripling of the number, maybe more than tripling, number of international NGOs, tripling of the number of multinational corporations. And so that's the kind of thing that I'm arguing in that book, and I have continued to argue that by paying more attention just to the high drama of international politics, which I'm not saying is not right, which is fine, it's right, everybody should study that, but at the same time, let's not forget other phenomena, such as the real growth of these non-state actors in the 1970s, which does force us, I think, to reconceptualize the 1970s, what was happening in the 1970s. Well, I do think that in my book, the chapter 1970s, that you may or may not have read, tries to argue that there were some very significant developments in the world in the 1970s. All of these things led me to become interested in phenomena beyond just NGOs and multinational corporations. It was just at the time when the phenomenon of globalization began to attract the interest of historians and sociologists and so on, I think in the 1990s. And reading their work, I became quite interested in phenomena, transnational phenomena such as migrations, right? I mean, migrations, you cannot quite deal with things like migrations or refugees in an ordinary survey of international relations. There are well-known textbooks, I mean, like Bill Keeler, my colleague at Boston University, a wonderful textbook called The 20th Century World, which I have used. If you're interested in the origins of the Cold War, that's the textbook to read, or the ending of the Cold War, that's the textbook to read. But if you want to find out something about migrations, you're not finding anything about migrations in that book. But can't we say that in addition to the coming of wars and ending of wars, migrations of people, massive millions of people, either voluntary migrations because they want to migrate as immigrants, or involuntary, like they're being forced out of their homeland, or being becoming refugees because of a civil war, as in Africa or as in the Balkans. These are just significant phenomena as wars. These things may just kill as many people as some wars, or diseases, spread of diseases. that have killed just as many people too. And so these kind of transnational things, the environmental issues, the environmental questions, no national boundaries. So to the extent that there is a problem with maybe a traditional study of international history, which takes the nation as the unit of analysis, you cannot study environmental history that way, because birds and fish know no national boundaries. I mean, they go all over the world. And if you're going to save them, or if they're going to worry about the quality of water, quality of air, and so on, I mean, we need some kind of transnational framework. It's something like that. I'm way past my time limit, so I'm just going to say something about one of my post-retirement projects. I'm at the point where I decided that I wanted to have some fun with my writing. And so I got together with seven other historians, not all over the world exactly, from the United States, South America, Europe, South Africa, to write a dictionary of transnational history. And we decided that it might be fun to try out some new ideas, new entries. If I were doing a dictionary of international history, then I would have wars, of course, peace conferences, the Vienna system, the Washington Conference treaties. These traditional things would have to be the major among the major entries, Cold War and all these kinds of things. But we decided that we're not doing a dictionary of international history as traditionally understood. We're doing a dictionary of transnational history. Now, what is a dictionary of transnational history? What should we talk about? Well, that's been quite a challenge to think about the dictionary. Professor Hahn says that he's writing a dictionary of U.S. Middle Eastern relations. It's a very exciting undertaking for anybody to undertake to do a dictionary. There are dictionaries of world history, there are dictionaries of this and that, American history, and so on. But how can one do a dictionary of transnational history, and what kind of entries are we going to have? Well, eight of us recently got together and decided on a list of about 400 entries. We cannot include everything transnational, because everything is almost by definition transnational. But we decided to have entries such as diaspora, brain drain, travel and tourism, baseball, fast food, vegetarianism, money laundering, biodiversity, germs, climate change, Halloween and Christmas, blue jeans, things like that. These are all transnational phenomena. I have never written about Halloween and Christmas. I've never written anything about blue jeans. I don't know if I was assigned to do the piece on blue jeans, I'd have to talk to my children to find out about that. But in any event, I think this is going to be a fun project, because you're dealing not with the traditional topics of regional systems or order wars or diplomacy, but these more, I guess you could say, cultural, even though not these are not all just cultural phenomena, but some of the transnational phenomena, biodiversity, money laundering. I think there has to be something about terrorism, of course. It's a transnational phenomenon. Migrations and so on. If we can do that, then it seems to me that we might be able to say that, yes, there is some kind of a genre, some kind of field, or even subfield called transnational history. And this is where I'm at. I'd like to conclude this by coming back to the question of Asian regional order, because there was an Asian Pacific regional order in the 1920s, where the United States, Japan, and China were supposed to define a new order. That was destroyed when Japan decided to abandon that to pursue its own order. So for many, many years, it's very interesting that the idea of a new order, if anybody mentioned a new order, in Asia, it had the connotation of Japan's imperialism, militarism, and aggression in the 1930s. But I'm surprised. I was back in Japan this January, and there was a conference bringing together Chinese scholars and Japanese scholars, and it was Chinese scholars who were talking about a new East Asian order. They wanted to look ahead into the future. They wanted to see how a new East Asian order or regional community could be established. And that's very interesting. I think, in part, this reflects the awareness that some of other Europeans have managed to establish a regional order in their European Union, which has been has had its frustrating moments, but by and large, certainly compared to anything that has happened in Asia, that's been far more successful. So cannot Asian countries also develop something like an East Asian order? That's the point of departure, and I think we're likely to hear more and more about that, which will be an economic regional order, such as the EU or ASEAN, Association of Southeast Asian Studies, or NAFTA, for America, Mexico, and Canada. It would be economic. It might have some geopolitical connotations in the sense that if Asian countries could come together to establish some kind of regional balance and regional order, like the Europeans have been able to do, that would contribute to regional stability. But quite apart from that, it might be a very interesting experiment, because it does seem to me that one key to the success of the European Union is not only that the French and Germans have decided they're not going to go to war against each other, or that they have decided to adopt a common currency, euro, but that they have also decided to develop some sense of shared European identity, right? Some people even talk about the European dream. There's a recent book about the European dream. The European dream is one in which you develop some kind of European identity, or that you are a European as well as being a German, and so on. In that sense, which enhances the sense of belonging to that, which may be comprehensible in the traditional framework of international relations, but I think there is something beyond that, because there are all kinds of transnational forces, a shared sense of identity, the shared values, shared concerns, and so on. That is not there at all in East Asia today, so it's still very superficial when Chinese and Korean and Japanese talk about any kind of regional order. They seem to be mostly talking about trade, how to augment their intra-regional trade. But ultimately, if any such regional scheme is going to be successful or vibrant, then they would have to develop, as Europeans have, I think, a sense of shared identity, shared consciousness. It's a very difficult task, because you have to share history. I mean, textbook writing, as you know, has been such a very difficult agenda there, but I think ultimately you've got to share certain things, even including shared memory. But thinking along these lines does make me somewhat confident that there is something to transnational history than just blue genes and biodiversity. There might be something to that. What I'm saying is that European Union has been a success that it has been, to the extent it's been successful, but not simply because it's just a geopolitical or trading kind of partnership. It has developed some transnational cultural awareness. Something like that would have to happen in Asia, but even in Asia's case, I don't think it's going to work until other Pacific nations are brought into it. The United States, Australia, New Zealand, and so on, will be very much part of the great, that larger community of Asian Pacific nations. But even to that extent, it does seem to me that transnational connections between China and the United States, and Australia and Japan, and so those kind of transnational connections, which are going to be very, very difficult to develop, but would have to be fostered. And if Turkey could join the European Union, Turkey, I'm sure in 25 years, Professor Hahn would know more about it than I would, just an amateur guess would be that probably 20, 25 years, Turkey might become a member of the European Union. If it does, of course, there are certain conditions, right, that they have to accept certain basic principles of democracy and human rights and so on. Same way, if China and Australia and the United States and Japan and Canada and so on are going to develop some kind of a transnational Pacific community, they too would have to share some basic transnational values. If that should come to pass, I mean, it will be long after Turkey had joined the European Union. So it might take 50 years, might take 75 years, but something like that might happen. If all of these are not just pipe dreams, but if one hopeful scenario for the history of the 21st century is going in that direction, then I do think that the concept of transnational history may have some value, in addition to simply something some one scholars talk about, transnational movement, but it might really begin to have some kind of a really transnational global meaning. Thank you very much.
The floor is open for questions.
Yes.
I'm interested in knowing whether or not you see transnationalism as being simply a 20th century phenomenon or a late 20th century phenomenon or post-1970 phenomenon. The examples that you, or the entries that you, right, that you listed for this dictionary are very contemporary. Mm-hmm. The concept of biodiversity. Mm-hmm. Is this, and yet as you say, the idea of the growth of the NGO as an institution, and the global corporation is a 1970s construction. Right. But I mean, I'm working right now on international banking.
Great.
In the pre-World War I era, mm-hmm, in which I see much, sure, of the same, sure, kind of,
right,
of a blurring of borders, where the nation state, mm-hmm, is not the organizing, mm-hmm, structure around which international policy is being made, domestic policy. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, is
this
just the 20s?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I hope you'd contribute to this dictionary, because that's the right framework, yeah. We are looking for contributors, and you're all welcome to contribute to this. Now, I agree with you that I did emphasize development since 1970s, particularly because I do that in my book and NGOs and so on. I think are particularly notable since the 1970s, but these things do go back to the 19th century. Our dictionary decided, even though one could say that they have always been transnational, some kind of trans-border connections since time immemorial, we decided to confine this dictionary to the past 150 years, 1850 to present. So there will be things going back to 1850. Esperanto, for example, was developed in 1887, so that's there. Things like NGOs like the Red Cross, and this idea of universal language, other developments, disarmament, for example. There's an entry called disarmament, but it's an interesting thing. If I were writing an entry on disarmament for a normal, usual dictionary, ordinary dictionary of international history, then I would begin with disarmament negotiations throughout the 19th century, 20th century. The treaties and what happened to them, which nations violated the treaties, and these kind of more diplomatic things. Things like disarmament in a transnational perspective, I think would focus more on transnational movements for disarmament, right? Not necessarily governmental movements, but NGO movements and peace organizations, religious organizations, so that you do have those in the 19th century in Europe and the United States, that is private individuals and organizations, and they would meet, I mean, in the case of socialists, of course, we had the Socialist International, the Second International particularly, in 1889, they begin to meet, talk about workers of the world, right? That they know no national boundaries, they should all unite against war and against armament. And so if I were writing, and which I think I will be writing, an entry on this element for this transnational history, I'd be talking more about the Second International, Socialist International, than about the Hague Conference of 1899, for example. And that would be a natural topic of discussion in an usual international history textbook. So I do go back to the 19th century. In the 20th century, too, we will be focusing on developments that were quite there in the first 70 years of the 20th century, as well as the last 30 years. Yes?
I was curious when you were talking of when you listed the various topics again. I don't want to pick on you if you only listed four or five. You don't know what the others are. But I was just curious. You didn't mention international institutions. And I was curious if you see those as part of transnationalism or if you see it in the maybe in the more traditional IR theory suggesting that international institutions are primarily
there will be
state issues. Right. NGOs don't actually, NGOs frequently do not refer to international institutions as international institutions. They call them global governance agencies or global organizations with a specific suggestion that that makes them distinct from sort of just places where states come together, the NGOs belong, ethnic groups belong, religious groups be present, right? And we look at the way the NGOs are sort of rewriting what the UN does, right? And I'm just curious if you see that or sort of like, well, the World Bank is just an interstate group.
No, actually, there'll be... No, there'll be an entry on World Bank, there'll be one on IMF, and there'll be something about IGOs, international governmental organizations, and there'll be an entry on international NGOs as well. So you could ask, well, so what's new about the World Bank or IMF, or why should a new dictionary of transnational history have those items? Well, obviously because things like the World Bank is of some tremendous importance. Not just in terms of international relations, right, or geopolitical relations, but in terms of development and the question of hunger and poverty, and all those transnational issues are very, very important. IMF the same way, and international organizations like UN and other international organizations will be written about not in terms of the founding of the UN or what it did during the Korean War, things like that, or what it did not do in some other instances, and some those will be more traditional kinds of approach to writing a piece on the UN. And as I say, I have to say that there's nothing wrong with that. I've done my share of writing such articles. But in a transnational dictionary, I think an entry on the UN might focus more about non-geopolitical, non-security issues rather than focusing on the Security Council. I have not written this yet, and I don't even know who is going to be writing it, but an article might focus more on UNESCO, for example, or the Economic and Social Council, or the Human Rights Commission, things like that. Just again, as an aside, last December, was it that there's a new high-level commission of UN that came out with a report and said there are about the threats to peace or something like that. That's a report. And there are about five or six threats, particularly serious threats to world peace today. And number one in that is poverty. Poverty and disparity of income comes at the very beginning. And then, of course, interstate conflict is there, clearly, and civil war is there. But then there are other items, that terrorism is there as well. But then, and terrorism, of course, comes both in the transnational as well. I mean, I think terrorism really is a more transnational phenomenon than international phenomenon. And then there are other questions, the environment and protection of human dignity and human rights. Those things are just the violation of human rights, the violations of our environmental standards are considered to be serious threats to world peace and world order today. And those that go into that, and to the extent that the United Nations has played a role in those areas, then the IGOs would be a very important entry for this of course, the same is true with NGOs. NGOs are very, very important. And we have separate categories of essays, some longer entries, 4,000 words. The shortest ones have only 300 words or something like that. We decided 4,000, 2,000, 1,500, 700, 300. And you might be interested in this. INGOs and would have 4,000. That's the maximum number of words. We decided that the INGOs are so important that there are 4,000 words. There is going to be an entry called Cold War. I think Cold War either has only 300 words or 700 words. Now, what can you write about Cold War in 300 or even 700 words? Now, that's our way of saying that we're not writing a dictionary of a traditional sort of world history. We're doing something different. We may be going overboard on that one, but at least the message is there, I think. If the Cold War has as many words as blue jeans, I think we're saying something about them. And in some ways, I think one could argue the spread of blue jeans or fast food and vegetarianism have been just as significant developments in world history as the coming and the ending of the Cold War. Yeah.
Interesting. You talk about the Cold War, and you mentioned earlier the difficulty of trying to pin down specific effects that these transnational groups have had on states. And I wonder if do you see states as really secondary to this kind of research, or does good transnational history include states?
Well, that's the thing. Well, I think it can include state. I'm just, for the sake of argument, I was differentiating state-oriented studies of international affairs and non-state-oriented studies. Because to combine the two, then we end up with a question, I think, I was saying, of the impact of these, right, NGOs and various other transnational forces upon interstate relations. And so everything becomes bound up with that, what a country does to another country, even in terms of diseases. I mean, there's no question about it, the state does become involved. And the SARS crisis a couple of years ago, right, a lot was said about what the Chinese authorities were doing or not doing enough to contain that SARS crisis or AIDS crisis in Africa today. What are the certain African states doing or not doing to contain the AIDS and so on. So I think state is always there. What we're saying is that even though the states are there, there are other players, other forces that have to be brought into the picture. And of course, when you talk about vegetarianism and things like that, then the state may not be that present, except in some countries that might force people to be vegetarians if there is such a state. But I think we're just trying to say that because traditionally so much history has focused on the nation as the key unit, I mean, that's how the study of history began anyway, right, in Europe in the 19th century. I guess we may be able to say, particularly now for the 21st century, that now the states are there, but some states have become failed states. Some states have willingly given up part of their sovereignty to join with other states to organize a regional community, so that we could talk about the Westphalian system, that kind of ideal Westphalian system in which the international society consists of sovereign states. That, I don't think, ever existed anywhere in the world. But certainly in the 21st century, the Westphalian state system is not going to function. Because for one thing, you have just one country in the world that's super powerful. And then others are not equal of the United States in terms of power, in terms of influence, in terms of economic resources, and so on. But at the same time, there are so many states that are not really functioning as states in Africa or even in in the Middle East. Many states are not quite the equivalent of European states. That becomes the model, I think, for when you talk about international affairs built upon the Westphalian system. That may have worked in Europe, but certainly not elsewhere. And for all these reasons, and of course containing terrorism, containing diseases, protect the environment and so on, do require interstate cooperation, but not just cooperation among states, but also the intervention by international organizations and NGOs and so on. I think we have this all the time now, right? Wherever there's a conference on the environment, there was the other day a conference, was it in New York, on women, a follow-up to the Beijing Conference on Women in 1995. Governments have certain agendas. I mean, this particular, right now, the United States government has certain ideas about women's rights, right, because of the pro-choice versus pro-life kind of issue, and stem cell research, and all those. And the state has its own ideas about these things, birth control. But then women, or either as individuals or as organized into NGOs, might have their own ideas, and sometimes they might be in conflict. And I think it's going to be very hard for any state, any particular state, to impose its views on all these individuals and organizations. So that's why I say that both of these are very important. It's a very long-winded answer to your question. Yes?
One criticism of the concept of transnationalism that appears in the political science international relations literature is that the concept type suggests a sort of flat or global world of flows crossing borders and so on, without calling attention to the hierarchical dimension of these processes. And for several decades now, there's been a large and growing literature on post-colonial theory, which does highlight, it's also transnational, it's historical, highlighting the hierarchical dimension. And so I guess I'm wondering how you see the relationship of transnational history to post-colonial theory and post-colonial history, sort of transnationalism from below in a sense, rather than from above. And just more generally, where does power fit into this conception of history?
Right. I think it's a very, very crucial question. And how does power fit into it? I think at this moment, we're just for the time being, we're trying to see how these other, how these 400 entries and so on, or in my own way, how my conception of transnational history might work without bringing in the power factor as the key overriding factor. It might not work, but I'm just trying to see that. Power that is in connection is the state's power, right? I mean, what Joseph Nye talks about is soft power is something else, isn't it? Cultural influence and those kinds of things, power of ideas. That might be different. But power, not into state power, but cultural influence or even cultural domination in sport or in food. Nobody tells you that you have to eat hamburgers, right? I don't think it's a state policy of the United States to force other people to eat hamburgers, hot dogs, but people do eat them. And I'm not sure, there may be a hierarchy there. But I think quite often when you talk about American influence and so on, I think we also have to keep in mind American, there have been a lot of foreign influences upon American food. And what's developing seems to me is a global cuisine that people all over the world are beginning to share their diets, their dietary habits and culinary traits and so on. It's those kinds of things, and there may be a hierarchy. The hierarchy, because there is the hierarchy of states notion in IR theory. And then there is the notion of anarchical society, right? I mean, either there's anarchy in international relations or there's a hierarchy. For time being, anyway, I'd like to get away from both. What's the idea of anarchy? Because if there were total anarchy, we cannot even talk about transnational anything. And the hierarchy, if there is a hierarchy, then that would consist of a hierarchy of nations that protect the environment, for example. The hierarchy of nations that are more successful in carrying out democratization of human rights. It's those kind of hierarchy rather than power-oriented hierarchies. That's what I'm thinking about right now. I mean, it's really quite fascinating. Or immigration, that how open are your borders to immigrants from abroad? I mean, that's a state policy. I think every country has its own immigration policy, so we have to bring state into it. But when you have millions of migrants, there is a hierarchy in the sense that if they were given the choice, immigrants would prefer to migrate to countries such as United States, Canada, Australia, and so on. And I think there is maybe a hierarchy there. But that hierarchy may not have that much to do with power as such, I mean, power in the traditional sense. Can we be rather loose about that, kind of construction? Postcolonialism is a very important question, and I think that said something about the lingering influence of our colonial ideology upon postcolonial states. I can accept that. I think that certain dominant ideologies that influenced or that determined the ways in which education, culture developed in the colonies, and how those kind of artifacts, ideas, and so on survived the end of empire. That's true to some extent, but I also would like to note that we can look at post-colonial states in Southeast Asia or Middle East or anywhere in terms of their own lingering traditions, religions, their values and so on, and how they have interacted across national boundaries. So I'm still groping with that. Rather than bringing power into it right away, I would be interested in things like religion, things like justice. There's going to be an entry on justice. I mean, how can you write a piece on justice in 4,000 words? It's very difficult, but it has to be transnational. I think that's going to be the argument I've been making. Rather than simply imposing a Western traditional conception, if there's such a thing, of justice, we try to see if there are certain transnational groupings, for example, the conception of justice. And I think perhaps we can do something about that too. Yes?
Yes, you talk more about migration. Yeah. It seems before the 20th century, people moved much more easily than now. And having someone, you know, be more expensive and difficult physically, and having somebody move to your country and be able legally to live there and work there, possibly taking your job, and then bring relatives, would be far more profound change in terms of international exchange than whether you buy blue jeans or eat hamburgers or use the internet. Mm-hmm. So it could be argued in some respects, maybe quantitatively things are much more restrictive now. Less interchange.
That may well be. But when you talk about migrations, we have to include slavery, right? Involuntary migrations as well. Indentured servants and so on. And immigrants, and I think they're
free
immigration, yeah. But I think it's very difficult. I mean, there are lots of people who are not free, but they have no choice but to move, refugees, internal refugees in Rwanda.
Yes,
but
that would
keep
them out.
Yeah, that's a keep them out. And the countries may be much harder to enter. I mean, U.S., people say, has become much harder to enter, even as a visitor nowadays. But there's no way that you can keep them out, I don't think. When we have 6 billion people in the world, and what is the story that so many, 75% or 80% or whatever, of 6 billion who live in the world today live below the poverty level, as defined by the United States or whatever, UN agency, I guess. I mean, there's no way that I don't think that you can just prohibit migrations, international migrations. They're just going to go where they can, whether to Europe or if the United States becomes more difficult to enter, then they go to Canada, as they have been doing. And I come from Japan. Japan is probably the toughest country to enter. But even then, even they are having to relax their immigration restrictions because of that. I mean, there's no way in which they can simply maintain their demographic purity, as they say. I mean, there's no such thing as demographic purity anymore. I don't think the entire world is really going to become much more diversified, I think. So again, that's predicting the future. We're not going to predict the future in this group, but we will trace these migrations and try to look at that not just in terms of immigration, legal or illegal immigration into the more advanced countries, but also migrations of people across the Indian Ocean and that kind of thing, migration out of China. The famous authority on the Chinese diaspora in Singapore, what is his name, Wang Gunshu, I think he's argued that there are just as many Chinese migrating into Southeast Asia in the 19th century as there were Europeans coming to the United States. And so, but we don't usually hear about them. But I think it's very important to keep in mind the global scope of these things. I'm sorry, it's not quite a satisfactory answer to the question, but I agree that migrations are just going to be extremely important. Really, not just important, migrations are probably the key to transnational history. If you're going to talk about transnational anything, then the border crossing of people, whether legally or illegally, would seem to be a most important phenomenon. People who talk about globalization talk about that all the time, right? And in the 19th century, there was this free flow of goods and capital and services, but not of people. But it may be inevitable by the end of the 21st century that whether states like it or not, there will be border crossings, legal or illegal. And there will be some protests. I mean, more recently, in Arizona was it that some private organization groups organized their own militia groups to prevent the coming of Mexicans and so on. And may well be that maybe they are not the state, and it's very, very interesting. The private organization decided that they would patrol the border. That really undermines the authority of the state, but in the wrong way, I think. And it's rather unfortunate that if all states or many countries that begin to do it that way, citizens taking up their own arms to patrol their borders, I mean, that would be the nightmare, I think. And if that should happen, and if that's going to be the scenario for the 21st century, there will not only be no transnational history, there will be no history whatsoever, I don't think.
You ended your talk by contrasting the European Union and the East Asian situation, where one, there was a sense of belonging to some kind of cultural entity, and in Asia, much less so. And your book is called Global Community. I'm wondering what you mean by the word community. And do you have the perception that any kind of sense of global identification drives these transnational movement actors that you're interested in? And I guess I'm interested in where consciousness about being part of them. Is the unit of analysis of some of your actors actually the globe? Or is it something much smaller than that? Or is there no connection? In global community, you just use the word community very loosely. It could have just been global relationships.
Yeah, I do use the term loosely rather than global relationship. I wanted to go beyond international relations. That's why I think I did not want to call it global relationship. Community, because Europeans call the community a community, and it's something like that, I think. So transposing upon the entire world something like the European community of the 1970s, something like that. I guess some kind of shared identity. There's a shared sense of belonging to the common universe or something like that. And of course, I start out with the fact that there is such a thing as planet Earth. And I guess people who write on globalization, I guess, do go back to the trip to the moon, 1969, and some other, you look at the Earth from the moon and recognize that this is just one planet, Earth. That idea that we all, 6 billion of us, living together, cohabiting the Earth, I guess that's the sense of global community I had in mind. It's more of a putative community than the real community, perhaps. But I also like to argue that it's not just a far-fetched pipe dream, because there have been others who have been talking this way the common brotherhood of man, that sort of thing. I mean, it's really, as well as Christianity, as well as Buddhism, every religion, I think, has talked about the basic unity of humankind and so on. So the idea that regardless of one's background or whatever, nationality, there is something transcendental, something that people share in terms of their diseases. And, I mean, if you're hit by AIDS or SARS or whatever it is, it doesn't really matter where you come from. Or the same thing with through the environment. And by stretching that, the argument would be that as the Universal Human Rights Declaration said in 1948, that everybody in the world does have certain rights. Again, it may very well be that not everybody shares the same rights, but at least there is the principle of the declaration, which goes back to the Atlantic Charter and goes back way beyond that and so on. I think some historians who work on human rights development in the United States seem particularly to stress the importance of the Atlantic Charter, because the Atlantic Charter talks not just about, this is August 1941, of course, the Atlantic Charter talks not just about the rights of all nations to live in peace, as Wilson had done, but the Atlantic Charter also says the rights of all people, not just nations, to live in peace with each other. It talks about the rights of all people, meaning all human beings. And what's surprising about the Atlantic Charter, it talks about even the enemy countries as well as allies. I mean, because U.S. was not involved in war yet at the time, but Britain was. And when Churchill and Roosevelt signed this thing, or issued this declaration, said that whether these people belong to Germany or Japan or to the United States or Britain, anywhere else in the world, they have certain basic rights in common. That's a very noble statement, I think. So it's these kind of things that I think were behind my idea of a community. And again, you say it may be just a vision, but visions have a life of their own, so to speak.
Let me follow up. If we look at the non-state history of the 20th century, particularly the latter 30 years where you've been concentrating some, do you think the phenomenon that you're describing is really an elite phenomenon that's actually shrinking while a mass population explosion is occurring in parts of the third world and elsewhere, producing people who don't think in these global terms at all, but think in much more narrow parochial terms? Of course, that's Huntington's thesis, that the parochialism is going to defeat the cosmopolitan trend you're describing. I'm just curious, as you look at the historical trend, we're not about states now, we're talking about cultural transformation. Whether you see trend lines one way or the other?
I think people who work on globalization talk about this, right, as the two sides of the same coin. Thomas Friedman's book and Hutchinson's book, Jihad and Macworld, that book.
Barber.
Right. I mean, I think they are aware of the fact that you do have the globalizing, more cosmopolitan, kind of international, transnational developments on one hand, and then there's the growing parochialism on the other. I think these two have gone hand in hand. The more globalized the world becomes, the more parochial, I think, to the extent that I guess it's a psychological phenomenon. If the world is becoming too much alike, interchangeable and so on, you want to hold on to your own tradition. And this has had some sort of negative effects, of course, in terms of Islamic terrorism and things like fundamentalism and fundamentalism is not just an Islamic thing, I don't think, but this fundamentalist anti-global parochial movements. So long as they're just movements, that's fine, but so long as they begin to, I mean, once they begin to use violence, that really does so much damage to the incipient global communities. So it is a phenomenon that I think we have to accept, we have to take into consideration. What can we do about it? I think it's, I mean, that's way beyond the scope of what I'm talking about, what this dictionary we talk about, but how can we deal with these two sides? At the same time, the world is becoming more global in the sense that the shared developments, ideas, goods, and so on. On the other hand, parochial tendencies. Well, it seems to me that the only way that anything can be done about it is to bring the two sides together, because otherwise two sides are going to fall apart. Is anything being done about it? Well, one thing that is being done about it, maybe again you might say at the too elitist level, is the initiative by the United Nations to promote dialogue among civilizations. And I have to accept that that's a pretty elitist phenomenon, but you have to start somewhere, I think. What has always interested me is that the year 2001, which is remembered in this country, of course, in terms of terrorism, was designated by the UN General Assembly, I think in 1998. The General Assembly voted unanimously to designate the year 2001 as the year of dialogue among civilizations. I mean, UN likes to designate certain years, like the year of women, and year of environment protection, and so on, decade of development. 2001 was to have been, what was, in fact, designated and was actually implemented as the year of dialogue among civilizations. What it did was to organize various conferences, workshops all over the world to bring people from different civilizations together to see if they might be able to carry on some dialogue. Again, it's a very elitist phenomenon. It's quite true, but I was rather impressed with that, the fact that when everybody's talking about terrorist attacks and so on, that there were these rather little noticed symposia in places like Lithuania, India. They're organizing these conferences all over the world to bring people of different faiths together to carry on some dialogue. But they may have some impact. That will not be enough. I think ultimately these things will have to reach out to the bulk of the population. So there are lots of problems in today's world. And I don't want to leave any kind of impression that I'm just being terribly naive. And maybe I am leaving that impression. I'm being very naive and very utopian. That may be the case, but my perspective on some of these things is in part autobiographical, I guess, that I have met so many people. Of course, again, I'm dealing with the elites such as you, the educated people. But at least among intellectuals, students, scholars, and some journalists, educated laymen, lay people. There is, I think, some shared awareness of that, of these problems. There's shared consciousness, I think, that I've long been quite struck by that. And when I write my books, and give speeches, I do it as a historian. I do it not as a historian of a particular country or a particular region of the world, just as a historian. It seems to me that I have managed to get away with it. That is, when I go to China, when I go to Britain, Australia, anywhere else, somehow that nobody asks me, you're speaking as a Japanese-born American scholar. I mean, people ask me questions, as you have all been doing, simply addressed to me as just one individual, right? And if I can do it, anybody can do that. And it's that kind of thing. And just as an orchestra might consist of players from different countries, and they don't really ask you where you're from. The only question is how good you are as a player. And it seems to me that if that's the kind of thing that's valid all over the world, one does begin to acquire some hope in that. It's that kind of thing that makes me somewhat optimistic.
Time for one more question.
I have a question. I'm kind of interested in, you were speaking about how the United Nations is, my question really was, do you think that the increase in international organizations, non-governmental organizations, and multinational corporations, and particularly your renewed interest in transnationalism, is speaking to, in some way, a decline in the nation state in any way, and particularly my interest in the United Nations? Do you think that one of the reasons why it's so difficult to reform the United Nations lately is because it's thinking in this kind of box of diplomatic history rather than transnational history of issues such as poverty? Security Council only deals with power. It doesn't really deal with poverty economics. Do you think that this is a problem?
I agree with you, and I think you said the question the way I would too. And I think this is really very congenial to my way of thinking. When we talk about international organizations like UN, we can do that in terms of power politics, in terms of the interplay of power. Particularly when you focus on the Security Council, I think, you know, we worry about veto power. And when was the first time the Soviet Union vetoed anything at the Security Council? Things like that. These are very crucial things because security, international security, is very important. But there's another aspect to the UN, as I mentioned, like the eradication of poverty, what they call sustainable development, or the protection of human rights and things like that. These are really more transnational phenomena. When you go to the General Assembly or the Economic and Social Council, the United States has just one vote, and the U.S. does not have veto power. Nobody else has veto power. And there, I think the United States does act as one member, and there, of course, it has to persuade other people, other countries. In the Security Council of UN, U.S. does not approve of some resolution being passed, it could just veto that, but cannot do that in other areas. And it seems to me that it's these kind of things that are becoming more recognized in the United States as well as elsewhere, that there's no getting around the idea of cooperation, some are cooperating with other countries. Whether the state, the nation state, is becoming weaker, I mean, is a question that people, sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists, I think, have been writing about, arguing about for the past 20 years or so. I don't think historians have been quite good at that. It's very interesting because, as I said somewhere in this book, you know, I was more impressed with the political science literature. It's political scientists like Jacobson, Hal Jacobson, being writing about international organizations in the 1970s, long before historians ever noticed that there was such a thing as United Nations. You know, the historians would talk about UN only in connection with the Korean War, things like that, but not in terms of the real significant development in international organizations. But now I think historians have, in the past 10 years or so, there's growing interest in international organizations, UN. And I noticed in the past 7-8 years or so, new books have been written or have been published on the League of Nations. It's quite amazing. When I was a graduate student, you just mentioned the League of Nations just to laugh at it, just ridicule it. It's a pipe dream of Woodrow Wilson, which the U.S. did not even bother to join, and so on. From the very beginning, it was a failure. But that's a scenario, and a textbook scenario of history of the League of Nations is, I think, just a pipe dream. It was just a visionary scheme that even Americans did not take seriously, and it collapsed as soon as it was established, and so on. And now you've got lots of books being written by historians, not lots of books, but some books have begun to be written by historians, like Dorothy Jones did a book on the League of Nations, where she talks about even promising developments even for the 1930s, and that's amazing, because usual textbook view of legal nations is that if it was not already dead by 1931, it died in 1931, Japan invaded Manchuria and got away with it, right? But Dorsey Jones shows that at the council proceedings, countries such as Bulgaria and Ecuador, these smaller countries, participated in the discussion, and they were extremely serious about defining international justice, crimes against war, those kinds of things. And she argues that it was on the basis of these deliberations that did not stop Japan. But nevertheless, it was these discussions at the League of Nations that became incorporated into the post-war Nuremberg Charter, so-called, that became the basis for the Nuremberg trials. Things like that. So if you look beneath the surface drama, a lot of things are going on. And in my own book, I talk about League of Nations Committee on Intellectual Cooperation. And 20s and 30s, quite unnoticed by most people, there are very promising developments, I think, in cultural exchange, which became the basis for UNESCO after the Second World War. But all of this having been said, this will not quite amount to the weakening of the authority of the state, of the nation state. The nation state still is the key in today's world. I think at least in those states where the governments function normally, when they're not a failed state, so-called, I think basically it's a matter of law enforcement, is it not? And what is a state? I think internally, I mean, a state has to function in such a way as to protect you and me, but also citizens against crime. But in a country where you cannot trust the police, or the police force is politicized, politicians are only seeking their own personal profits and so on, you cannot trust anybody to protect you, and therefore you decide to take your life in your own hand and begin to arm for yourself and so on. Or you become a bandit to start out against the government. You know, so long as there are more enforcing states with a system of law that is honored by its citizens, then I think the state is going to remain. I mean, you cannot entrust the United Nations to protect your life. If you are attacked by somebody, it's the government of the United States, which is a state government or a local government. You don't go to the United Nations if you are attacked by somebody personally. So that I do think states are going to be very important. That's what Adam Smith used to talk about, right? The policeman, night watchman state. Every community needs a night watchman, some kind of police force, a law enforcing agency. Where transnationalism comes in might be the establishment of some kind of transnational law enforcement mechanisms. Like there's an Interpol there, International Police Organization. That's a very important development, I think. It may be intergovernmental, but nevertheless, it's an international organization. And I think we need to catch drug traffickers and so on, people who are engaged in illicit trade of prostitution. Interpol is very, very important. But beyond that, it does seem to me that there have to be certain shared legal principles and practices. Otherwise, there will be no real transnational network. To the extent that the state exists to protect its citizens, if you go to a neighboring country, if that neighboring country has a different definition of what constitutes murder, for example, what constitutes crime, then there could be no real cooperation between the two. And I think this is a big problem coming up to Asia. I mean, Asian countries have so many different legal systems that no Asian order is likely to emerge unless they begin to share some of their legal principles. Otherwise, you go to another country and then you might get into some problem, but you could not quite count upon that country to protect you and so on. So that question of legal sharing it's terribly important. And I was very impressed with the fact that recently some of the law enforcement officers from Asian countries have been meeting together to see if they might do precisely that, if they might be able to pool their resources and develop some kind of a common or shared system for legal courts and law enforcement. I think that's very important. I mean, European community, likewise, I think if you commit a crime in France, you're committing a crime elsewhere. And that, I think, part is very, very important. It may very well be that the future of either transnational history or the future of the world in part might depend on that, depend on whether all the countries in the world, at least many countries in the world, would be able to develop these kinds of legal procedures and practices that could be shared.
Well, thank you very much. Let me close with just a couple of announcements. First of all, we do have a reception just outside the door in the atrium. All of you are invited and encouraged to stay. Hopefully we can continue the dialogue in small groups or one-on-one with Professor Irier. And then finally, I want to alert you that we have two more meetings of the graduate workshop yet this academic year. On April 28th, 3 weeks from today, we'll be meeting in this room with with Michael Duran of Princeton University, Department of Near East Studies. We'll be talking about U.S. policy in the Middle East, I think in the context of current events since 9/11. And then in about 6 weeks, on May 13th, which is a Friday, Robert Dean of Eastern Washington will be here to talk about his research in the gender dimensions of American diplomatic history. So do take note of those dates, and all of you are invited to come back, those of you from political science especially, to join us historians. Thank you very much, and please join us for the reception. Thank you.